here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
It's Friday, the 7th of March. I'm Christine.
And I'm Costa Pradanovic. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:02 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories and segments are Karina Bazim's interview with Rachel Chardrand and the president of Women in Film and Television Vancouver discussing women in film.
As well as a piece produced by News 101's past news director, Chirag Mahajan, discussing the state of photojournalism in Canada.
Later in the program, we will have a report and discussion about the ongoing crisis in Ukraine with News 101's Alistair Melling, and a brief discussion of the upcoming Paralympic Games.
And now some headlines for today. In campus news, us, CITR, hosted Fun Drive this week. CITR 101.9 FM is hosting its annual Fun Drive, a fundraiser with the goal of supporting quality community radio. This year, the proceeds will be going towards moving CITR into the new student building. So far, we have raised $27,558 of our goal of $35,000. Here to talk about this year's Fun Drive and how you can get involved in donating is Campus Coverage Coordinator Chirag Mahajan.
Hi, CITR listeners. I wasn't aware that I'm going to be talking about this. All right, excellent. So CITR has raised, like you said, $27,558. And we are looking forward to, at the very least, reaching $30,000. But our station goal was initially $35,000 following our last year's fundraising efforts of $34,000. So we are going to be spending most of that money on operational costs and moving to the new Student Union building in November, as it is currently being built and I do believe has been delayed from a September opening to November. So exciting times. And tonight, of course, we're having our Fun Drive finale party at the Biltmore. So it's going to be awesome.
And how much longer are donations open?
Donations are open for up to a month after Fun Drive.
Awesome. Thank you.
You can, of course, donate online at citr.ca/donate and click on News 101 because we love you guys.
Thank you guys for that.
Great. So in local news, Vancouver creates a 90-peg guide to improve understanding of First Nations culture. In order to improve new immigrants' understanding of First Nations history, culture, and current issues, Vancouver launched a comprehensive booklet called First Nations, a guide for newcomers this past Tuesday. Councillor Andrea Raymer said that newcomers want to learn more about the history but lacked an accessible source, something this pamphlet hopes to address. The guide joins those already provided by Edmonton and Winnipeg and Vancouver's more general guide for new immigrants. The guide is one of five projects that cost the federal government $460,000 and is available to the public online.
In national news, Quebec is due to hold an election on April 7th. Parline Marois announced Quebec's upcoming election this past Wednesday, kicking off a 33-day campaign online 18 months after the Parti Québécois won its minority government. Marois said that the government had made great strides to improve the province and still had work to do, saying, quote, "We have a plan and a team to realize this plan. Should the Parti Québécois come out of the election with a majority government, another referendum will likely to follow."
The Harper government's ending of the investor class immigration stream has rubbed some Chinese immigrants the wrong way. The issue here is that people are angry that they've been waiting for the last couple of years for Canadian immigrant status, only to be told that the program has ended. They argue that applying to Canada had a high opportunity cost, as they could have been they could have put time and money into applying to other countries like Australia, the U.S., or Britain instead.
Those are your UBC campus local and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Independent radio station at odds against major broadcasting corporations.
I want CITR.
Dead.
I want CITR.
His family. Dead.
I want a radio station.
Burnt to the ground. I want to go to
Vancouver, BC.
I want to piss out his ashes.
Was given an opportunity they thought they would never get.
It's UBC. It says here that they want to give us a new radio station.
But they were up against one major problem.
How are we going to pay to move all our stuff into the new radio station?
CITR Radio presents the 2014 Fund Drive, a heartwarming story of compassion and generosity in which listeners like you donate to help support the station you love.
I just donated and it felt awesome.
For more information, go to www.citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
So this past Sunday was Hollywood's crowning glory that is known as the Academy Awards. Every year, the top players are pitted against each other for a shot at holding that solid gold naked man with the anxious fear of the polite music coming on to shoo them off stage. So we asked here at News 101, how did the Canadians do in all of this? I spoke to senior programmer Steve Gravestock at the Toronto International Film Festival, who gave me a lowdown on how TIFF has championed the work of many Canadian filmmakers who have gone on to the Oscars, including Jean-Marc Vallée, whose film Dallas Buyers Club took home 3 wins, and Denis Villeneuve, whose film Prisoners walked out with a cinematography nomination, along with the visual effects editors who shared wins for Gravity. He says that Canadian filmmakers are always showcased at the TIFF Bell Lightbox, as well at Canada's Top 10 Film Festival, which provides major exposure and the opportunity to work with big American producers. Films that premiere alongside Oscar-nominated films like Gravity, 12 Years a Slave, Dallas Buyers Club, and Philomena at TIFF give Canadians access to a very large pool of resources. But is that really what the goal is? In fact, Steve says, quote, "The Canadian Screen Awards are frankly far more interesting and unpredictable than the Oscars. There are so many amazing and wildly different films nominated," end quote. And indeed, there were this past Wednesday. But a more important issue in the film community has been the amount of female participation in the industry. Gravestock accredits TIFF to judging films simply based on quality, which is reflected in the fact that there have been years where 35 to 40% of the films programmed have been directed by women, which is far above the normal statistics. And not just established female filmmakers either, but first-time directors as well. A last remark from Steve, he states that, quote, One of the craziest, wildest things I ever saw was the bizarre Hollywood triumphalism after Catherine Bigelow won for Best Director. It was as if they'd solved the underrepresentation of women in the film industry by giving her a prize. It's hilarious and genuinely depressing at the same time, end quote. To comment more about this, we go to Karina Bazim's interview with the president of Women in Film and Television Vancouver, Rochelle Chandrand.
So hi, Rochelle. Thank you so much for joining us. We know things are really busy with the Vancouver International Women in Film Festival right now, so we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So as the president of Women in Film and Television Vancouver, can you tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yes, of course. Women in Film and Television Vancouver, we're a member-driven, not-for-profit society, and our main objectives are to further the artistic and professional development of women and to recognize and promote the artistic and professional contributions of women in Canadian screen-based media community and in the community at large. We're part of, we're one of the chapters of Women in Film and Television International, which has 40 chapters around the world. So it's really exciting.
So as it is International Women's Day on Saturday, mm-hmm. We want to discuss the lack of presence of women in this previous Academy Awards that was this past Sunday,
okay.
And in the commercial film industry in general. So what do these numbers look like? Like, what is the male versus female participation in the industry currently?
Well, it's actually a really interesting time because for the first time there's actual hard research being done, and so we actually have these stats in numbers. I can only really speak for Canada, except I know through my own reading that they're on par with the States as well.
Mm-hmm.
So basically there's less than 20% of films are directed or written by women. So that's 1 in 5, basically. And the sad thing is that it hasn't really changed over the years. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary today. March 6th is our official birthday.
Oh.
And, we're starting a year-long celebration. So it's really exciting, but it's also sobering when you look at the stats, and they haven't changed very much.
Well, happy anniversary. So do you think the problem lies more so in the lack of female directors or just females who want to get involved in the behind-the-scenes industry, or more so the industry not giving female directors enough opportunities?
Film production schools are roughly, give or take, every year, half women. So that's
okay.
Really interesting that the young girls are coming into school, but then after that there's, I don't know, it's hard to say because there are systemic issues, definitely, and if you talk television, it's a different situation than in Canada feature films where we don't have studios but we have funding bodies. So it's kind of interesting. We're really excited about these stats, but I think we can kind of lose ourselves in trying to analyze why the stats are like they are, because like I said, they've been like this for 25
yeah.
years. Like nothing is changing.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do is we use these stats and we now go to the industry and say, okay, what we've been saying all along is true, like it's common sense, but now the numbers are there in writing, so now what can we do about this? How do we move forward? Instead of getting stuck in the mentality of the stats, let's look for opportunities. So something that's really exciting that Women in Film are doing is we are just announcing tonight at the opening night of our film festival,
yep.
that we are creating a national genre lab. And this is through support with Super Channel. And it's so exciting because it's going to give 5 teams, female writer, director, and producer, all 3 have to be female, and it also has to be a female-driven story, and it's going to be a year-long program where we go from scratch, from the script, all the way through to getting funding and getting the project out into the world marketplace. And this is just the first arm of a larger project, which is the National Accelerator Project. But for this first year, we decided to focus on genre because it's an area where women underrepresented, but making some real inroads. And so we're so excited that Super Channel has come on board to support it in the development stage. And then they're excited about where it goes from there as well. So that's what I mean. Like, this is what we want to do instead of, like, getting stuck in the stats, because where that conversation goes could just lead us into this quicksand. Like, so yeah, we're trying to look and, you know, raise the consciousness also around audiences, you know, kind of, we want to see a paradigm shift of what it means to be a female storyteller and what are women stories and who are our audience. Like, I think there's so many limiting beliefs around who the audience is for female films, female-driven films.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned, like, stories about females, because I was reading an article saying that a majority of stories just center around a male character or protagonist. Also, relating it back to the Oscars, Cate Blanchett, her acceptance speech, literally, was pretty much a paraphrase of that. She said, "For so bravely and intelligently distributing the film and to the audiences who went to see it, and perhaps those of us in the industry who are still foolishly clinging to the idea that female films with women at the center are niche experiences. They are not. Audiences want to see them, and in fact, they earn money. The world is round, people."
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Like, when I heard her speech, I was like,
"You go, girl."
You go, girl. That's what it's about. It's a paradigm shift. I have three nephews, and we talk, especially my 21-year-old nephew, we talk film all the time, and some things we agree about, some things we don't agree about, but his favorite film is directed by a woman, and he didn't realize it was directed by a woman, and it's American Psycho, which we could have another discussion about that, but the point is that he didn't even realize that that's what it was.
I've noticed, obviously, that the acting categories at the Oscars are separated into best performance by a female and best performance by a male. And I've read numerous blogs saying that the Oscars and the Golden Globes and every other award show, basically, should be segregated into female-male awards for all the categories, not just acting. Do you think this would bring about any progress? Or
personally, no. I disagree with
that. I agree.
I think that in the short term, it would shine a spotlight on great films and great female-driven films and great female filmmakers in the very short time. But very quickly, there will be an asterisk next to the award. Be like, oh, she won a Best Directing Award at the Oscars. Oh, but it was a Best Female Director Award. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I don't think that that's the answer. I think that if we do two things, if we focus on developing female-driven projects, either behind or in front of the camera, and great projects, which they are out there just waiting to be told. So if we support the development and production of those projects, and if we bridge away to the audience that I know is out there dying to watch these films, then the awards will come. Like, also what needs to change, like, just because you mentioned the Academy, is the Academy is, like, something like 70% men, white men over the age of 50. Well, no matter what, they're not going to. That needs to change. So I think looking at awards is, they're subjective regardless, right? We give out an Artistic Merit Award at the Vancouver International Film Festival, and it has to be a woman director, writer, editor, cinematographer. But it's not a separate segregated award. The award is special because we want to celebrate, and it's from women in film, and we want to celebrate a female filmmaker. It's not a special segregated award at the festival, if you see what I mean, the difference.
Yes.
So that's great.
So moving forward, you do have your festival coming up this weekend. Well, it starts today, the Vancouver International Women in Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it runs until Sunday, March 9th.
Yes.
So what kind of programming is being presented at this year's festival?
Okay, so tonight, our opening night gala is Karen Lam's sophomore feature, Evangeline. Karen Lam is a local director.
Okay.
She's kind of becoming the Canadian, if not global, queen of thriller. So we're so excited that this is the first time we've had a thriller open the festival, so it's kind of exciting. And she's a local success story for sure. She's just making inroads, so we're excited to show her film. And we have screenings all weekend. We have 33 features and shorts, another thing that's really exciting, just to show the talent that's out there, we had over 500 submissions this year from around the world, and our submission criteria is quite high. You need to have three women or three roles filled by women. It can be the same woman, either writer, director, producer, lead mm-hmm. actress, or cinematographer. So those are very strict criteria, and we've had, like I said, and the films are amazing, and these are films that the audience here in Vancouver wouldn't normally get to see. We also have panels and Q&As with visiting filmmakers. There is one panel that I want to mention specifically for your listeners.
Okay.
Because Saturday, in honor of the International Women's Day, our industry panel is called Catalyst for Change, and it's basically everything you and I are talking about right now.
Okay.
I'm moderating it, and it has Lauren Davis from Telefilm, and Maureen Davis from Super Channel, Candice Elzinga, who's the
casting director. Yep.
Casting director, yeah, did Elysium and lots of local and American projects. Lindsay Hodgson, who is a distributor from Pacific Northwest Pictures, and Shauna Hardy-Mishaw, who's the executive director and founder of the Whistler Film Festival. So what I've done is I've brought together these decision makers to help to give their perspective, but to help us create sort of like a vision moving forward of how this paradigm shift can take place. And I want the audience to be filled with people of all, filmmakers and film lovers, but also like new ideas. So I would love if your listeners would come out and share.
All right, so that it's called Catalyst for Change?
Yes, and it's
Saturday, everybody.
10 a.m., and it's at the Van City Theater, which the whole festival takes place. And then it's followed by a short program of the WIFD, so that's the International WIFD chapter, screenings, which we do every year. And they're shown at the same time around the world. So, and we have a local short in there as well, Carlene Kyle's The Weather Girl, which was Leo-nominated for Best Screenwriter. So, yeah, come spend the morning with us.
Thank you so much for joining me, Rochelle. I know the festival will be extremely successful this year, so good luck with the festival.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Okay, talk to you again.
Thank you, Karina. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Due to overwhelming demand, a second night has now been added to Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds Vancouver performance this summer. While the June 30th show has sold out, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, along with special guest Mark Lanigan, will be returning to the Orpheum Theatre the following night, July 1st. Show on sale on Friday, March 7th at 10 a.m. at all Ticketmaster locations and at Ticketmaster.ca.
Tree don't care what the little bird sings. We go down with the dew in the morning light.
For more information, visit nickcave.com.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gaela Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Our next speaker here is Viola Thomas. She is also a residential school survivor.
Part of our obligation at where I work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada is to inform Canadians on the truth. But I believe that as more Canadian people understand that this was Canadian law and Canadian policy, and that Canadians need to take responsibility for their shared history, I also believe that Canadians have a responsibility to resonate reconciliation with the First Peoples of this country. And what did we learn when we went to the school? We learned how to be bullies, how to be mean to each other, how not to love, how not to feel a great sense of pride of who you are and where you come from. I learned about racism, and I didn't know what that was. I really didn't know what racism was. I learned about sexism. And as a young girl, I didn't know about sexism. There were many forms of abuse, not just the physical, but the intellectual abuse. To always be reminded that you're stupid and that you're nobody. To be told by your teachers and by the folks from the church that you're a savage, you're a squaw. And I just want to close with one of my heroes, a woman by the name of Winona LaDuke. And I offer this to all of our brothers and sisters who were abducted to residential schools. And I offer this with a good heart to non-Indigenous people so that they will pick up the torch. And this is what she says. There is no social change fairy. There is only change made by the hands of individuals.
You have just heard At Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend brought to you by Environment Canada. Tonight, there's a rainfall warning in effect, cloudy with a 40% chance of showers, rain beginning before morning and a low of 9. On Saturday, rain at times heavy with about 20 millimeters expected, and 30 millimeters over northern sections, becoming windy in the morning with a high of 9. On Sunday, expect periods of rain and a high of 10. So that's the weekend's weather forecast, brought to you by the Vancouver Weather Bulletin, courtesy of Environment Canada.
Our next feature segment is a piece produced by News 101's past news director, Trag Mahajan. The piece includes two excerpts from a talk by Pulitzer Prize-winning Canadian photojournalist Paul Watson and interviews with Dr. Stephen Lee, chair of the IR program here at UBC, and co-editors-in-chief of New IR Photo Journal, Outside In, Chereen Kim and Sally Shin. They discuss photojournalism and where this medium is heading in the future.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM at UBC Vancouver. I'm CJ, CITR's Campus Coverage Coordinator. On March 2nd, at the Liu Institute for Global Issues, UBC's International Relations Program organized a guest lecture on photography and conflict reporting by Canada's only Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Paul Watson. Paul has covered the world's conflict zones for about 25 years and won a Pulitzer Prize on spot photography for his famous photograph of the body of an American helicopter crewman being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu in Somalia. In recent years, he has reported extensively for the Toronto Star from Afghanistan and the Canadian North. Here are a few excerpts from Paul Watson's talk.
I'll apologize in advance. The photographs will not appear in any particular order. They're from many places over some 25 years of conflict reporting, and they're really just there to remind you of the reality of what I'm speaking of, because I find that when you talk about war and journalism, because so much of it is filtered for a general audience, we start to forget how brutal it really is. And on the eve of perhaps another conflict in the middle of Europe, it's good to remember that ordinary people suffer terribly in these things, and we shouldn't be speaking of it in the clouds. We need to get down to where it really is. And that's really what I've devoted my life to, because I work from this simple premise that I'm an ordinary person who's been fortunate enough to survive repeated conflicts, and I've, through that experience of surviving, experienced and witnessed extraordinary things. And I've reached certain very fundamental conclusions, which I think that other ordinary people would reach themselves if only I can bring them to that place through my reporting and my photographs. So that's why they're up there. A year ago, just a little over a year ago, I was in Aleppo, Syria. And you know, the people I was working with, the Syrians, would only stay with me in a week. They were living in Turkey and would come in and out with journalists, the dwindling number who were willing to do it in those days. Now almost nobody will do it because the kidnapping threat, although bad then, is extreme now. I was lamenting the fact that this wasn't getting traction, that the story, as horrible and terrible as it was, and how we all agreed that it was necessary for somebody to do something to stop this, it wasn't registering in the Western mind. Certainly not the way Bosnia did, or Somalia, or all of these previous conflicts. And I was trying to figure this out, talking too much, and someone got upset with me, a colleague. And he said, well, nobody wants to get killed or kidnapped. And I conceded that that's not a good thing. And I said, but journalists have been killed and kidnapped in conflicts since they began. And then he said, well, it's all on YouTube anyway. And that's when I finally got it. And that was a long way of getting to the most important point I want to leave you with today. It's all on YouTube anyway. Now, I concede that I'm a representative of the old media. I'm a bit of a dinosaur. I want to make this case to you that we are losing something important. Part of that, as we go to digital media, which, for one thing, sort of targets your interests, you are more and more less likely, it seems to me, to stumble across something you're not already known to be interested in or be biased towards, according to Google or Yahoo or Facebook or whoever else is feeding you this stuff. You're getting great information from great sources, but it's now being siloed into what some algorithm says is your interest. In the days that I'm longing after, you would have stumbled across this stuff because it was in a broad audience newspaper or magazine, something that was trying to appeal to as many people as possible. Now, what's the consequence of that? It's all on YouTube anyway. It's true.
This event was hosted by a new international relations photography journal called Outside In, which is funded by the Liu International Relations Community Fund. The Outside In Photography Journal is a student-run publication that features articles and photos submitted by students who have traveled abroad. I had an opportunity to talk to the co-editors-in-chief of Outside In, Shireen Kim and Sally Shin. Here they are.
My name is Shireen Kim, and I'm the co-editor-in-chief of the Outside In Journal.
And my name is Sally Shin, and I'm also the co-editor-in-chief of the Outside In Journal.
So could you talk about the origins of this magazine?
We started our magazine in 2012 through a photography exhibition, which was held at the Global Lounge. We basically did the same thing we did this year. We got students to submit their photographs, and we displayed them. And we got a really good feedback, and this year we decided to print it as a publication.
So Steve basically had the idea in the beginning. So when we were doing the exhibition in 2012, he was the one who was basically leading it. And I guess because he is the chair of the IR program, he wanted something a little bit more of a community for IR students, so he wanted to start the exhibition, and he himself is personally interested in photos. So he's been very supportive throughout this whole process. This year, it was mainly the students who were doing it, and he was just kind of giving us moral support, guidance, and just giving us a lot of advice. But he's been very helpful through the whole process, and he was giving the talk today, which I found very compelling.
We encouraged writers to be really personal about their stories. We wanted to display their original emotions and experiences that they had abroad. So we wanted the stories to be really original and personal and inspirational. In terms of, visually, the photos had to be really good.
They had to be compelling,
had to have really nice composition.
And you wrote about Havana.
I actually just traveled to Havana last summer, and I happened to take a lot of pretty pictures there, so might as well submit some photos.
What have you guys got planned for the future months?
We are recruiting editorial, we're hiring editorial board for next year, so we hope that it would continue as annual.
We're really hoping to find some gems and continue on the photo journal, because we're really excited about it, and we think that it's really helpful to students to see what other students have been up to and be worldly within our UBC community. So we definitely want to continue it as an annual thing.
I also had a chance to speak with Dr. Stephen Lee, who is chair of the International Relations Program at UBC. Dr. Lee opened the lecture with a presentation about his travels to North Korea as a tourist and academic, and showed the audience the captivating photographs he took while being guided through the North Korean city and countryside with a tour guide. Here is Dr. Stephen Lee.
I'm Stephen Lee, working in the Department of History at UBC. This is the second time that we've had public speakers associated with the photo project. The first time, though, we didn't have a journal published. So this is the first time that we have a journal published and speakers at the same time.
So could you talk about the support you gave to the magazine itself as a mentor?
The support started in 2012, I guess. But this one, I provided some assistance, some support, but the students really took it on themselves, and I think they did a great job.
So your opening talk was about your frequent academic trips to North Korea. Could you talk about some of the academic reactions to your trips in here at UBC?
After my first trip to North Korea, I gave a presentation in the department based on the photos that I had taken that previous summer, and so it was mostly just amongst my colleagues. But I learned from them as well, especially my colleagues who had studied and lived in communist areas, Soviet Union or China, in the 70s and 80s, and shared their experiences and their observations about North Korea with me, and some of the similarities that they felt about my own presentation with their own experiences.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Stephen Lee, for talking to CITR.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
The Clothesline Project was started by a group of women in the United States. Historically, it was a vehicle for survivors of violence to express their emotions by decorating a shirt. They then hung the shirts on a clothesline to be viewed by others as a testimony to the problems of violence against women. SASC, the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, supports male, female, and trans survivors, and their clothesline is not restricted to only women's experiences of violence. Friends, family, and loved ones of survivors and anyone concerned by the levels of violence in our society are also invited to decorate a shirt. Clothesline 2014 will be hosted during the week of March 3rd to the 7th between 11 to 3 on the Sub Concourse. Please join us and bring your friends.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Christine.
And I'm Kostya Pradanovich. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Our final contributor segment comes from Alizair Melling, who is in studio to give a brief overview about the ongoing crisis in Ukraine.
Yeah, I'll try and make it brief. So, I really wanted to do this because there has been an awful... What's that sound? It sounded Australian. There's been horrible, horrible coverage on everything to do with Ukraine, especially in the Western media. No matter where you go, there's just so much... There's so much biasness going on from every single person. So I wanted to start with a little bit of a history of Ukraine, why... why it is in its position today. So mainly I think the best place to start is right after World War One. This is when the Bolshevik Revolution occurred. Ukraine was sort of split between Western powers, the Habsburgs, and the Russian Empire. They both broke down. And then there was a power grab. Now the power grab came from Poland. Poland, which was obviously a country that was resurrected in 1918, quickly tried to assert itself in the region and took large parts of Western... I think they tried to take Kiev, but they didn't manage to take Kiev from the Bolsheviks. Now, the Bolsheviks were fighting against... I think from my history class several years back, they were fighting against the Whites. And one of the main... it's a little confusing bit of an oxymoron, but their main rival was called the Black Army. They're called the Whites, but it was the Black Army. This is the Black Army. The Black Army was basically the thorn in the side of the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, taking power within the West. Now, after several years, I think they collapsed in 1922, this guy, I can't remember his name, his first name is Nestor, they finally collapse, they kill him, and most of Ukraine comes under Bolshevik control. Now, apparently I meant to mention that I'm not an authority. I am a student of UBC, only 21 years old, so don't listen to anything I say. Thank you, Iqbal. this is 22, they took in power. Ukraine was mainly made up at that time of Poles, ethnic Germans, which were encouraged to come in during the Catherine the Great, who was partially German herself. She encouraged a lot of Germans to come in and ethnic Ukrainians. Now, Stalin did not, when he started doing his reforms in, so when he kind of came to power, which you can sort of say 28 was when he kind of took control after Lenin died in 24. He did not want an independent Ukraine. Now, Ukraine is very, very important. It's known as the breadbasket of Europe. It's where most of the food comes from. It feeds several million people and even more millions today. So he did not want them to become independent, so he begins starving Ukraine. The proper, full-on starvation. Around about 10 million people die over the space of about 5 years. This is worse than the Holocaust. But nobody really learns about this, which is kind of horrific. But he starves Ukraine, and then afterwards he starts moving many Russians into the area. And this is kind of similar, to what the Brits did with Ireland. We starved them during the 1800s, and then 1700s, 1800s, and then when they when there was very few of them left, we move over Scots and English people, which is why there's actually the sectarian violence in today. So similar situation, what happened there. So most of this eastern, so you hear a lot of in the news of Ukraine being part of, so many Russians, ethnic Russians in Ukraine during this time. Now this is deliberate Stalinist policy to move the Russians in and to create a more obviously Russian-friendly environment. The Crimea, this horrific treatment from Stalin, Ukraine is completely devastated, even though they've got a lot of Russians then in during this time, completely devastated. So when Stalin dies in 1953, Khrushchev kind of, well, this is the next premier, we can call him? Yeah, we can call him premier. He comes in officially in 1956, but he's sort of in power. There's a little bit of scuffle going on, but he's essentially in power by 1954. And he is very strong ties to Ukraine and moves the Crimea, which is obviously the focal point of this crisis, in 1954 from Russian territory to Ukrainian territory. And the significance of the Crimea is that, well, it's mainly Russian, partly because of Stalin's policy to sort of remove most of the ethnic Ukrainians and the Tatars who were in during this time. The kind of, I think, slightly foolishness of this is that they have their main Black Sea port is Sevastopol. Now, I'll move on to that a little bit. But that's essentially the main reason why Crimea is part of Ukraine today. It was actually officially part of the 300-year, I think it was the joining of Ukraine and Russia, or Ukraine became part of Russia. It's sketchy, but it was celebrating the 300-year anniversary of some big event, and it was a bit, I don't know, showy. So today what we have, obviously, it's horribly complicated, and I recently started reading into this, and it's mainly to do with gas. It's not to do with sovereign power. The West is sort of claiming, oh, well, you could possibly invade Russia, how could you possibly invade a sovereign country, completely unaware that they did that twice in the last decade. So, which I think it was John Kerry said, you cannot, did any of you see this? John Kerry said, John Kerry said, came out and said directly, you maybe could have done this in the 19th, 20th century, but in the 21st century, you cannot invade a sovereign country under phony pretexts. Which is just, I mean, he's clearly got short-term memory. Pardon?
Wasn't it like something more like, erase borders,
and
use like a different line.
I think that was a later quote. Okay. This is the one where they first came into Crimea. No, it's fine. So the significance of this, I'll try and move into the oil, and maybe Iqbal, you can contribute, perhaps, even though you haven't got a mic, so nobody could probably hear you. So the significance of the Crimea is they've got Sevastopol, which is their main base. It's where they've got their Black Sea fleet. The Black Sea fleet is crucial, and actually very crucial, because it gives them access to the Mediterranean. Now, obviously, the Mediterranean is completely dominated by the EU, but an interesting fact, actually, this came out on WikiLeaks. You know, if you remember Syria, you know, we were talking about invading Syria. This is very, very late August. It was a week after the, maybe not even less than a week after the chemical attacks. We were seriously considering invading Syria, and actually this didn't come on any mainstream news. What they believe to be American ships, they fired two Tomahawk missiles towards Damascus, obviously constituting an act of war. The Russians, which had stationed most of their fleet from the Black Sea, coming from Sevastopol, the Crimea, along the border of Syria, shooting down these two missiles, because they don't actually go too fast. I think it's about 500 miles an hour, so they're not particularly fast. So they shot them down and obviously clearly prevented a war in Syria, or an external war. Obviously, the internal war still continues. So it's very important for them to have this. Now, the reason why they've invaded, it was a bit random why Putin invaded Crimea at this specific time, was because there was it wasn't entirely clear who was going to, when they kicked out Yanukovych, obviously the previous president, it wasn't entirely clear who was going to take power. So there was kind of a power struggle between a person who was imprisoned but under the Yanukovych government, a woman called Yulia Tymoshenko. She was imprisoned in 2011, I believe. And then there's, and obviously the person who's now the acting prime minister, or president, pardon me, who's Arseniy Yatsenyuk, I believe that's Yatsenyuk, that's better. And he is accused by many people of being fascist. Well, not fascist, but semi-fascist. He's very, very right-wing in his policies. Now, when it came out that Yatsenyuk was going to come into power, he obviously had ties, far more ties with the West. Now, Tymoshenko, the woman, she would have, Moscow was hoping that she was come into power at this point, because she would have been more sympathetic, shall we say, to the, she'd have been more sympathetic to the pipeline that was meant to be going or all the pipelines that are meant to be going through Ukraine. I think, Iqbal, you can talk about the crisis, because I'm not entirely sure. I only just discovered this probably about less than an hour ago. And they when they realized that it was going to be a Western-friendly president coming in, that was what sparked the moment when they decided to invade Crimea. There has been no, they don't intend for any more war at this point. I think several statements have come out from Russia that they don't intend to increase any more any more aggression within it. But it does seem, obviously, we know that there's going to be a referendum in the next 5 days. Sorry, it's going to be 8 days now. But I wanted to know your opinions on what you've seen after that history lesson. I hope you may have changed your opinion or so.
I just wanted to comment on, I believe it was in the last few days, the Obama administration is trying to push through Congress, I think it was $1 billion
aid package. And the same for the EU as well.
Same with the EU. And
it's 1.5,
and
I think.
And tying that back to natural gas, because I think it's Gazprom, which is like the state-owned natural gas company in Russia, state-owned natural gas company, that Mieta Vistrashi had like back in the day. Because they would give a favorable rate to the Ukraine on natural gas prices.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in 2013, or maybe 2010, 2012, they made a price adjustment. And to ease the effect of the price adjustment on the Ukrainian economy, they gave them a discount, but that was like, it was like a futures hedge. So in the sense that like, it'll be cheaper now, but if to pay us back in the future.
Okay.
And so now Gazprom is trying to collect the $1.2 billion they feel the Ukrainian government owes them. And so, like, even the aid package, you could say, comes back to natural gas. And, like, a lot of Russia protecting its interests in the Ukraine is, again, to natural gas. And that's what both countries are doing. So I was looking at some statistics on, I mean, I think I was mentioning CJ off-air earlier, how in, like, kind of geopolitical spectrum, European interests in that area also become U.S. interests in that area.
Of course.
And so, because, you know, Russia's right there. It's spheres of influence argument. And so currently in the European Union, natural gas, I think this is as of 2013, makes up 23.4% of all energy consumption. So that includes,
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And so that includes cars, that includes every across the board energy consumption. And it 23% of which goes to power generation, and so like household power, and then industry is 23% of that 24% of energy consumption. So you can see both in economic terms and as well as like day-to-day energy consumption, the importance of natural gas. And so just some quick fun facts for you about...
I think Alex wants to come in.
Yeah, no. So for those of you who aren't intimately aware with or of the situation, the ongoing situation in the Ukraine, what's been happening over the past few months is there were a number of protests following the former president, who's now been ousted, decision to go back on trade talks with the EU. The Ukraine had been negotiating with the EU. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, the Ukraine has always been a border, a borderland. Yeah. The name literally means
borderland in
and
Old Serbian. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And it's always been sort of the gateway between the rest of Europe and Russia. And that serves... To go back to what Iqbal was talking about, that also serves as a place for pipelines to go, because you don't really have that much land, so it needs to go through certain other countries to come out of Russia or into Russia. And, you know, that's the Ukraine is one of those pieces of land where it has to go through. So the Ukraine's been rather unstable since after the former president, who has now been ousted, said he would renege on these trade talks with the EU. There were mass protests. The president attempted to institute laws against protests that were, simply put, ridiculous. They would stop you. They would have you arrested for up to 6 years for simply meeting with somebody and talking negatively about the government. So pretty outrageous, almost borderline, you know, police state laws we're talking about here. That only served to make the protests more violent. And these protests did eventually lead to the ousting of this former president and the establishing of a new political kind of group.
And to add to that, one of the first things that they actually did was they took away Russian as an official language within within Ukraine.
Right.
So there has been Russia. The issue is, and I like the mentioning of obviously the meaning of Ukraine being a borderland. It's stuck. It's not entirely split ethnically. It's, as I previously explained, it's very divided. And it's being constantly pulled from either direction and pushed in either direction from both the EU and Russia. So it's very, very difficult to say who's better, who's... It's not... I can't see there's any wrong or right in this. Everybody is acting in their own national interests. And so the problem is what I've seen on the media is a lot of this, you can't attack a person's sovereignty. It's got very little to do with sovereignty. It's entirely to do with gas and who can control. It's pretty much gas, because as I said, I think it was 23% you said?
Mm-hmm.
23% of gas that comes through into Europe comes from Russia. So it's very, very, it's really, really important place. I looked through most of the, I looked on a map of the pipelines, and I would say must be around about 60% of the pipelines come through Ukraine. I think there's plans. Russia was trying to reduce its, its reliance on these pipelines, and they're building ones that are going to go through the north, the
Estonia,
Baltic Sea.
Estonia, that's the one. Latvia.
And then there's another one that's going to go through the Black Sea as well. To supply Greece.
And I was wanting to ask you, maybe you've done more research on this, I actually don't know. The Orange Revolution in the Ukraine.
Oh, right. No.
And so I was wondering, because one of the first things they did when the president was ousted was release the former president, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of talk about her connections to the gas industry as well.
Tymoshenko. Okay. Yulia Tymoshenko. Okay. And that was the person who sort of appeared last month. It seemed like she was going to be the person who came into power, but obviously now it's Yatsenyuk is the guy. So unfortunately, we're going to have to finish that off. Just hopefully that was a slightly better reporting on what you have seen on CNN or CBC. That's the one. It's an awful program.
CBC is great.
It's horrific.
CBC is fantastic. CBC's but fantastic. The main thing we want to reaffirm here at CITR. is that there is no right side.
There is no clear good.
While you could make the argument that Russia is invading the Ukraine, Russia's own stance is that it's the people of Crimea rising up in self-defense. So there are lots of different
perspectives. That's what the U.S. said in Afghanistan.
Which goes back to how complicated
and
muddled this issue
is. So you're saying that's fine for
is.
Russia? I'm not getting into this.
Okay. The last thing I want to say is next week I'm going to be doing a show on... I'm trying to get a few professors to come in and offer their opinions on more of the current day. Because I've given the background to it. We want to do more of current day. So tune in next week. I will try and let some people, listeners, know somehow. To that. I have been Alistair Melling.
And just right before we do our outro, I just wanted to mention that although the Fun Drive finale is tonight, you can still donate to CITR. And you can still donate online at www.citr.ca. We do need money for helping with operation costs as well as moving into the new sub. So with that, Alistair, take it away.
Alistair?
Hello. So, am I introducing myself? So, that's our program for today. I'm being Alistair Melling. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteers' efforts. If you'd like to share any of your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on the website citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News ITR, News 101. Thank you very much. I have been Alistair Melling.
And I'm Kostya Brdanovich. Today's show is produced by Iqbal Ahmed. Don't forget, daylight savings time will begin at 2 a.m. on Sunday, March 9th, so set your clocks forward 1 hour before you hit the hay. We would also like to cordially invite you all to our Fun Drive finale tonight at 8 p.m. at the Biltmore. Thank you so much to all our listeners who donated to News 101. Your donations help keep CITR alive and kicking. From our entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.